Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay.
And me, Kyle Major.
And this week, we've got not one, but two guests. Yes, we're joined today by Dr. Stephen Lee from the University of Cambridge and Dr. Nick Evans from the University of Southampton. Separately, Nick is a bioengineer and Steve is a physical chemist, but together they are the sensational podcasting duo behind The Science Shed. Welcome, Nick and Steve.
Hello.
Can each of you say who you are so our listeners know which voice is which?
I'm Nick Evans. I'm from the University of Southampton and I'm also Steve's comedy podcast wife.
He is my podcast wife. And I'm Steve Lee. I'm a chemist from the University of Cambridge.
So what is The Science Shed? Sell it to us, guys.
Nick, do you want to go for it?
Yeah, The Science Shed is a podcast where Steve and I basically talk a load of crap over a period of time. And we sort of talk about sciencey things.
Yeah, we try and sell it as an irreverent ramble through the undergrowth of academia. That's our tagline.
I like that.
That was way more pithy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm prepared more than Nick does. So we're both academics, and we decided to set up a podcast because we feel that there's a lot of aspects of academia that are totally impenetrable. Like people are, when I stand up and give a professional talk, it's very it's very structured and ordered, and I have to pretend I understand exactly what I'm doing. But actually, the reality of science is completely different. We wanted to try and set something up that kind of challenged those ideals, I suppose.
That's really cool. Yeah.
And we just like insulting each other on the air.
Yeah.
And that's a significant proportion of the podcast, right?
Pretty much.
It's to show people that, you know, we've got normal lives and we have normal thoughts. We do normal things, yes. But we're also kind of working academics at the same time.
Scientists are human too. and you have the experiment today is very much down to you guys, and it's still a surprise for me and Kyle.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, so. Literally, not a clue. Could you just tell our listeners what they would need equipment-wise if they wanted to take part at home?
So if you want to take part at home, you'll need a few things. You'll need a bottle of tonic water like you would get in your G&T. You'd need a glass of wine, a glass of white wine specifically.
You can also put gin in the tonic.
I like where this is going.
You don't have to put gin in the tonic for the experiment, but I'm sure we're going to have these things left over after the experiment, so I don't know what could possibly happen afterwards. And the other things you want is you want a blue light, or you can do this just with sunlight, but ideally if you get a blue light. So if you get one of those, if you've ever seen one of those really small little like purple key fobs, you see, they're very cheap little flashlight or a torch that's purple. You need one of those.
Great.
Sounds good.
Kyle, do you want to introduce the brain teaser or shall I?
What did the scientist say when he found two isotopes of helium?
Wait.
Hang on.
Two isotopes of helium. I don't know.
Well, we'll reveal at the end of the show.
Yeah, keep thinking.
Steve's going to be so upset.
I'm going to get it. I'm going to think about it all the way through.
If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape. Now, Nick and
Steve.
Oh,
I know what it is now.
Wait, hold it, hold it. Revealing at the end.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm ever so smart.
This is the perfect time to move straight on to what is your first song and why?
This first song is a personal favourite of mine because I was in love with this performer in the 80s when I was like an 11-year-old boy. It's called Kids in America by Kim Wilde. And also, we're playing it because Steve and I met when we were in America, didn't we, Steve?
Yeah, we met. We were both postdocs in California, and Nick and I met over a crowded room and bonded over the fact that we're English, so we like to go to the pub and talk about things, whereas Americans like to stay at work. So that's why we're playing it.
Looking out a dirty old window, down below the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why.
Down, down, Leon, without going. Down, down, Leon.
Bloodshed was first conceived in a pub and born on the 10th of June, 2016.
How long was the time between the conception and the... Well, how long was the gestation, I should say, and the birth?
I think it gestated quite rapidly because I have very strong genes. And when they mingled with Steve's genes in sort of an ideas kind of mating...
I feel dirty.
They were propagated very, very quickly, weren't they, Steve?
Yes, Nick. So to answer your question, Matilda... So I think it wasn't that long, it was about a month, I think, between deciding to do it, and then we did a terrible first episode, which is still up, where we just kind of, we spoke into a really crap microphone, can I swear? We spoke into a really bad...
We were basically in a pub in Waterloo, and we were just having a beer, and Steve and I are mates, and Steve's in Cambridge, and I'm in Southampton. And basically, we met in the middle in London often, just for a pint, and we're also working, like, proper work, science work. So we're talking about science work to do, get things done. And we just sort of enjoy talking to each other. So we thought, why don't we just record this and bore a whole load of people with it? we really like podcasts. We're both big Adam and Joe fans.
Adam Buxton.
So we wanted to try and kind of recreate that in like a big science bun.
Well, for us, I think the podcasts that I enjoy listening to the most are the ones that you're kind of eavesdropping in on a conversation between two people that you wouldn't normally hear. And we thought that maybe somebody might want to listen to us talk in the pub, as we do, about sciencey things, because actually sometimes we talk about something that's absurd, like some bad science that's on a movie or something. And other times we're talking about specifics of receptor expression on insect cells or something.
And I think sometimes it's like totally over-sanitized, the stuff you see on the TV and on radio programs in general. And you hear about, it's all polished stuff about something that's...
Nice sound bites.
Yeah, and it's more interesting to hear the rough and the ready, the rough and the tumbles from the world of academia, do you know what I mean? Because it's quite a dirty, horrible world sometimes. And we can't actually libel people, but we can talk about the sorts of things that go on.
It was something like science is an endeavour of coffee stains and shirt sleeves or something like that.
Like that. I mean, I wouldn't say anything as grandiose as that, but I think there's value in... hearing the process, right? So whenever you hear that soundbite, you don't see all of the failure that happened behind it. So it's kind of strange, which is the exact opposite of actually when you do academic research and science in general, is that nearly everything we ever do fails. So we're kind of uniquely qualified, I think. If you're a surgeon, that 95% of the heart valves you replaced failed, you wouldn't be a surgeon for very long. But 1 in 20 with an experiment is a pretty good hit rate. So I think we were kind of saying we enjoy, we fail all the time, and that's part of the process. But when people see science, they just see the stuff that worked. And I think by showing us messing up, not knowing the answer to things, but trying to think about how we would solve a problem, even if we don't understand it, we were trying to, I suppose, kind of communicate the process rather than just the output.
If it was all so much of the kind of conception and gestation was in pubs, why is it the science shed and not the science pub? Oh,
by the way, the gestation period is the same as for a squirrel. also rabbit.
I love that you've looked that up.
Or a muskrat. Or a wombat.
Wombat, definitely. We'll go with
a
wombat.
I saw a wombat once. It walked into my tent in Australia. They're like giant walking cuddly teddy bears.
Yeah. I love them. They've got so really cute. Hard bums. They've got like a... They've got like...
Is it chafe?
They've got like a cartilage
I'm
covering.
Sorry about
so that they can't... So to protect them from predators.
Right.
Kyle's Twitter handle is actually wombat butt.
It is.
Is it really?
I really like wombat.
Okay, so definitely.
Definitely wombat.
From now on, the Science Shed has the gestation of a wombat.
It's that'll your be baby our wombat.
Thanks for our tagline, guys.
The hard ass.
The hard ass of science.
Yeah.
So why a shed?
So a shed. So we went through a series of. In fact, I think it's on one of our podcasts, but we went through a series of trying to work out what we were going to call it.
We just couldn't think of a name.
Nick and I totally disagreed on everything. But what we do quite like is that kind of...
What did you want to call it?
We
wanted to call it Slackademia. We agreed on Slackademia.
Slackademia is what we went for. But
then someone else has got it.
Yeah.
No.
Like most of my good ideas, someone else has thought of.
I can't remember the other ones. Some of them were terrible.
They were terrible. But we like the idea of kind of, like shed science, of people just going in and experimenting with things. You don't necessarily have to be a lab in a lab or a university to do science, and it's a bit of a kind of ramble in general. So we thought, if you go into the shed and you go and do some experiments, and whether that's building, sort of fixing an engine, or you know, doing some advanced microscopy. It's all the same thing.
And I have to say, we have recorded from a shed.
We have on our anniversary. We went into a shed.
Amazing.
Which is quite hard because neither of us own a shed big enough to record from.
I don't know. Mine was almost big enough, but.
What's your second song on your mixtape today?
I think it's going to be a. I've sort of picked this because Steve's very, very messy.
This is incredibly messy. Why do you say that?
He's incredibly. If you didn't know, he's a very successful high flying scientist, much more so than me. But he's useless, and his lab is just like a shithole, basically.
can I
and his house as well. He has very poor hygiene in labs and in his house. Okay. I, on the other hand, slightly poorer scientist, but my lab is usually quite tidy. And my house is quite tidy.
He's a biologist. They have really boring labs where everything's in its right place. So our second song is Everything's in Its Right Place by Radiohead.
Everything's in its right place. In its right place.
Shed has been recorded everywhere, from the floor next to a bin at the BFI to the 28th floor of Guy's Hospital, Nick's dining room, and Steve's bedroom.
Those are some pretty amazing locations.
I like the bin one. That one's really classy.
It was clandestine podcasting. It was actually at Christmas, and so there was a Christmas tree next to a bin. So we hid behind there so no one could see us, and there was a plug that we had to steal power from to be able to plug in our recorder.
Was that because the BFI was integral to your episode, or you just like wanted to be at the BFI that day?
We had gone to see...
Itinerant, basically.
Buckley's, Adam Buxton... in live show.
The podcasting god.
And we actually, when we stole that power, we were actually stealing it from the Adam and Joe merch people. So they had like a little stall set up, and we were kind of just next to their little stall table behind a pillar and a bin and a Christmas tree. But it was fine.
It was great.
I think it added to the energy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, in the presence of your idols.
We never knew when we were going to get like dragged off or told.
Did
to
you get caught?
We didn't. No, they were very accepting of us.
So we did tweet Adam Buxton afterwards, and he responded to us to say he wasn't going to talk to us. But he did respond. So he says, yeah, I acknowledge you, but you're not important enough for me to speak to.
Too busy.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm really excited about this part after you revealed the ingredients of the experiment.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Well, you could probably hold this glass.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Yeah. I've been handed a wine glass.
You have?
So let's put some wine in the wine glass.
What am I holding here?
We're having... the white wine into my wine glass.
And I'm pouring another beverage, tonic water.
So why are we doing that?
That's so good. That's like advert sound. Okay, so we've got one glass of tonic, one glass of white wine.
So what we're going to do is we're going to recreate an experiment that was first conducted in 1845 by John Herschel of the Herschel telescope.
I thought it was George Stokes.
No.
Oh my goodness.
I knew we were going to get this wrong intentionally. So George Gabriel Stokes, who was the first person to coin the term fluorescence. I don't know if you've heard the term fluorescence. So we, both of us have work, or I work in fluorescence exclusively in my lab. It works on developing new fluorescent molecules. And Nick's PhD was in fluorescence. He was using fluorescence to try and sense glucose for people that are diabetic. Is that right, Nick?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah. So this principle, if you've heard the term, you know, people say fluorescent clothes or whatever, but all it means, scientists like to make things more complicated, but all the term, a molecule is fluorescent if it sucks in one color light and spits out a slightly longer wavelength or a slightly redder version of that light. So in tonic water, there's a compound called quinine.
Mm.
And quinine was actually the first fluorescent molecule and the first person to discover that. So if you've ever been in a club, and you've seen someone with a glowing blue drink
in the club.
In the Yeah. What you're looking at there is the black light from the in the club or whatever you're in or whatever is absorbing is imparting energy to those quinine molecules, which is exciting those molecules, and they're re-radiating light that's in a slightly blue shift, so it's blue. So what we're going to do now? So the way
basically it's like glow in the dark. But Steve went.
Yeah. It's not glow.
You have a fluorescent gin and tonic.
You know if you go to a nightclub. Completely wrong.
You know if you go to a nightclub.
Isn't that phosphorescent?
That's right. Thank you very much. You can stay.
If you go to a nightclub and there's some UV lamps, you can see things. It's a similar type of phenomenon.
Yeah,
so
that was originally discovered by John Herschel, who did it via in his Cambridge chambers, where light came in at one angle, passed through a solution of quinine sulfate, which was the first, he called it an epipoplic solution.
Wow.
But what was the stuff with the stained glass window? Because I heard it came through the blue bit of a stained glass window,
So we brought in a lamp now, which is a kind of UV lamp. And we're going to replicate the blue light coming in through the stained glass of.
Describe what you see, guys.
Well, it is really blue.
It's gone so blue. It's like it's glowing and giving off the light itself. So it's amazing.
So just for the people listening, Steve is shining green. Blue light onto the glass, and it kind of looks cloudy blue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So if you now pick up your wine and look at the quinine through the wine.
Pour another big one.
So what the wine's doing is acting as a long pass filter. So what that means is it's only it's not allowing the purple light of my torch to be seen, but only the blue light of the quinine. So hopefully, when you're looking at it, you see it should appear more blue, but the wine might not be good quality enough.
This is like my wife's size glass of
wine. Wait, so when we look at
about two glasses in one.
When we're looking at the.
What I'm doing is I'm kind of. You're pointing the torch kind of at me, and I'm looking at the torch through my wine, and I can't see the torch.
Yeah,
exactly
amazing.
Right.
But I can see the color of the wine
so
once I'm looking through
exactly
the wine.
Exactly as we'd expect. So we've got something that's a bit more sophisticated here. We've got some yellow safety specs that should do exactly the same thing. Matilda's going to put these on and look at the same thing. And what that does is it filters out only the purple light, so you can only see the blue light, so there's no purple light, and you should see it should be glowing.
Yeah,
So this phenomenon of fluorescence is used a lot in biology. So we use it and it's used a lot in chemistry as well, because it allows us to be able to attack. If you imagine if you took a molecule of quinine and you attached it to something that's biological
Sorry.
In nature.
On me.
It's so hard. what you can do is you can look at the position. You can use it as a tag, as a little molecule, to be able to find where something is you can't see. So that phenomenon we use is for high contrast in looking inside
cells.
So
you could tag something with a quinine molecule, because I've only ever heard of people tagging stuff with like the fluorescent thing from a jellyfish.
Exactly right, yeah.
But you could actually use a quinine molecule.
Exactly right.
In actual fact, there are things in your body which are fluorescent by themselves. So in all of the cells in your body, you've got a molecule called NADH.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that's produced when you chomp up sugar. And when it's reduced, when it's got that hydrogen atom, NADH, it's fluorescent. And it actually fluoresces in a similar way to the quinine, same kind of wavelengths. When you metabolize glucose more, you get more of that in your bloodstream. And effectively,
So your blood will like be more
your
fluorescent.
Your cells in your skin become more fluorescent when you're metabolizing more strongly. And that was kind of the principle of my PhD thesis a long time ago, actually, and that's why we were trying to use fluorescence.
Is that an effect you can see, like, in the club once
yeah.
you're standing there? You know, at the point where you take your top off, and
you gently glow.
You basically look like running around and go, "Oh my god, that guy's hyperglycemic."
Yeah.
Shit, you better get him on the insulin. Yeah, he's had one too many strawberry daiquiris.
Strawberry daiquiris. Where are you from? The 1973.
Wolverhampton. That's what we drink in O'Neill's in the town centre, mate.
Okay, fair enough.
Is Brian coming later, by the way?
We can invite him if you want.
Brian does have an invite, so he can turn up whenever he wants.
I really want to meet him.
All right, mate. How you doing?
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
I'm all right.
Well, have you snuck into Imperial College?
It's nice to be here. It's another type of podcasting with these people here.
And you said you never have guests. This is clearly a guest.
I know. Well, I like to come in. Nick's never seems to be here when I come in there, though.
Yeah, crazy. It's a bit like Clark Kent, isn't it?
Who was that? He's gone. Brian's gone. He's always coming in here, that bloke.
Yeah.
Crikey.
What's song number three?
So when George Gabriel Stokes, who's to bring it back to science, when he first saw fluorescence, he described it as a beautiful celestial blue. And so in honour of that, we're going to play Sound and Vision by David Bowie, because the first line of that is blue, blue, electric blue.
Thoughts on vision.
Steve have ever discussed on Science Shed was beer made from the yeast of ladies' vaginas.
Actually.
I think Nick can answer this one.
So when
could you actually, like, drink it? Did you try it?
It's on the internet. You can find it. I was amazed. So I was actually, like, reading into something else. There was some kind of, like, beardy hipster, a bit like what Steve wants to be. And he was going out into the...
I think he's doing quite well.
It's a very impressive beard.
He was going out into the undergrowth and collecting, like, different strains of yeast from the wild. And then he was brewing his own craft ale and selling it to wankers.
I'd say it's more of a woodsman than a hipster. He's not going to ride a unicycle.
I don't know, man. He was on the borderline of that general area. But anyway, I got sort of reading about interesting beers made from interesting sources of, you know...
Yeah, you say yeast in the wild. I only know of yeast as being in bread.
Like. So I didn't understand this either. So basically what they do is they go and, like, just go and pick up an old bit of, like, tree bark or something. And you know, like, when you have those, like, Petri dishes and you can grow bacterial or colonies on them. So what they do is they then get their tree bark and they wipe it on, like, a Petri dish and then grow up the types of yeast and bacteria that are present in those on that tree bark, and the idea is that you then use that to cultivate to take sugars and turn them into alcohol and therefore make your beer from it. That's the idea.
It's basically a gimmick, but
a total gimmick.
Having wandered into this realm, okay, I started to sort of
a podcast, you know, gold.
Start with it was kind of like acceptable, interesting behavior, and then there was a very dark corner of this world where there was a company that I found in, I think it was in Eastern Europe, like Poland or something, and what they were doing was, because all of this is about marketing, right? You got your beardy man who goes into nature, you know, it's a great selling point for craft beer. And some other people in Holland, in Poland, had worked out, well, actually, maybe we could sample swabs from ladies' bits and then use that and then market beer based on...
I wonder if it was like buy your girlfriend her own beer or something. Well, yeah, they turn it into like a gift.
Exactly.
From a...
Except on the website, when you go on it, you can click on lots of different ladies and see pictures of the ladies.
Allegedly.
And then order beer.
Oh my God, that's creepy.
Made from their bodily fluids.
So wine, as you mentioned, is actually quite easy to make wine. It's actually quite difficult not to make wine if you squash a grape, because the simple sugars that are present in grapes are very easily and readily converted into alcohol.
Do you know, once I bought a fruit juice from that shop in London Bridge Station, and I got back to my desk, and it was alcoholic fruit juice.
Yeah. Whereas beer is much more complicated, because beer takes complex sugars and has to break them down into... You have to trick... grain particles into germinating, so then they take their complex sugars and make simple sugars, and they're the things that the yeast can metabolize, so they can only deal with very simple sugars.
Mash.
Yeah.
So you make it think it's going to grow, and then
think of all these poor little grain particles that are being tricked that it's springtime, and they're like, yes, I can finally, the
sun's
out.
And they start, like, churning up.
Exactly, and so they turn up all of their complex sugars into simple ones, because they need them to turn sunlight into leaves, and then they just get turned into beer for Nick to drink.
Why didn't Brian introduce song number four?
This one, the singer in this band, he's from where I'm from, he's from Wolverhampton, he's called Robert Plant, and he's a singer in Led Zeppelin, and he's going to sing this next one. It's called The Lemon Song.
Yeah.
News just in. A whale imitates human noises.
Falcon X heavy launch.
The oldest Briton found had DNA which reveals dark skin and blue eyes.
And Wikipedia is the Ivory Tower's foundation.
Cool, I want to hear about that one first.
Dark skin and blue eyes, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah, so they found this guy from around the Cheddar region. So someone said online that he should be called Cheddar George or...
Oh, that is beautiful.
Or they were giving up. And he is from 10,000 years ago. And from the remains of his body, I think they had some skin.
It was his bones. It was his bone from his ear. And they ground it up.
And they were able to analyse that it was dark brown skin and that he had blue eyes.
It's actually done... There are genes which make your skin pale. Yeah. And they didn't have any of those genes.
So he is proving that there was darker skin in the UK before, and they thought it came from the Middle East was where the pale skin came from when people from the Middle East came to the UK.
Oh, really?
Maybe it was to do with their diet, being very vitamin D poor, and so they weren't able to produce very much pigment, melanin, right, in their skin.
So their skin reduces the pigment so that their skin produces it without them having to eat it, right? The lighter skin is like a...
Lighter skin
is a mutation because it means that you're more receptive to the sunlight and you can produce the vitamins that you wouldn't otherwise be able to produce if your skin was too dark.
They had to have pale skin so they could make it from the sun. Yes, that makes sense. Sorry, I was not explaining that well. Thank you, Claire.
So the biggest story recently was the SpaceX.
Wasn't it cool?
It was so cool.
I have a little very special place in my heart. I'm kind of dead inside emotionally, but when it comes to space, the 5-year-old in me... It just pours out with joy. I just there's something just incredible. It makes you proud to be a human being that we build a massive explosion to put an old car on the way to Mars for no reason.
Playing David Bowie on its console.
So this is SpaceX company, right? They had the first successful launch of a really big rocket, and basically they used to launch these smaller rockets, and they essentially strapped 3 of the rockets together, the idea being they can lift quite a heavy load.
It's now the rocket that can lift, that's commercially available today, that's the one that can lift the most amount of payload into space.
It's almost as powerful as the Saturn V's were.
It's amazing that we're nearly as good as 70s technology.
Very nearly But inside it, to show that they could lift off so much, they put Elon Musk's red Tesla car.
And they put a little guy in there, a little mannequin, wearing the new SpaceX.
Playing on the radio was Space Oddity.
Of which you can't hear because it's in space.
Yeah, but that takes away from the majesty.
The magic,
of it.
Yeah, maybe.
I find the whole thing a little bit strange, weird and creepy. Even watching the news reports, because I feel like I'm suddenly in like a James Bond film and I'm watching a news report from inside a James Bond film about something very bad that's going to happen. Because there's kind of an evil
ominous
mastermind thing.
Nefarious.
And he's one man. And he's called Elon Musk. He's not called like Mike Smith. He's called Elon Musk. What type of name is that?
It sounds like he lives in a hollowed out volcano. I'll agree with that.
Yeah, definitely. And has an evil cattle.
Do you know that? He tweeted the first time. One of the advantages of all of the SpaceX rockets is they can be recycled, right? So the most expensive bit of a rocket is the actual material that goes into making it. And historically, you've thrown those away. And so one of the big things that SpaceX did as a way to reduce the cost of commercial spaceflight was to try and reuse the main rocket.
Yeah, so those land back down after launch,
exactly,
don't they?
They took them a long time to figure out how to do that, and they had lots of wasted rockets along the way. But the first time they had a successful landing so they could reuse the rocket, Elon tweeted that if this works, I'm definitely buying an underground lair.
Why
he's good because he's kind of self-aware.
Yeah. Why are you calling him Elon? Like, you know him by his first name as well. That creeps me out too.
Sorry, Grand Leader Musk.
All hail.
I find that whole thing when they landed totally creepy as well, because it just looked like someone had wound the film backwards, because it was like some kind of ballet.
It was perfect.
They came
it?
Down in reverse, like in Red Dwarf backwards, that episode.
Yeah.
And they just perfectly landed on the landing pads.
Yeah, so apparently, this thing was made of 3 rockets, and the 2 outer rockets managed to land again. The central rocket, which had the payload on it, went up into orbit. It managed to fire the car into orbit, but then when it tried to land, it missed the The pad?
Not just the pad. It was an automated robotic pad.
Yeah.
There was a little robot.
Like a drone thing.
No, it's driving around, just watching up in the sky, waiting for its master to return from the heavens to catch it. God. And he missed it.
And then they had a couple of burns to go into an orbit around Mars. Yeah. And apparently you could see them. People tweeted photos of the burn happening over California. So you could see the rocket performing its final burn maneuver. And
what's a burn maneuver? Is that just when it uses its thrusters?
Well, yeah, so when it's in orbit, if you're in an orbit, you're kind of in a stable orbit, you're going around the planet. Yeah. If you want to get into a different orbit, you have to accelerate, and that acceleration is firing your rockets, basically. And so it was firing its rockets to try and get into an orbit that would send it to Mars. And unfortunately, they've slightly overshot, so the car is now on its way to the asteroid belt. But that's, you know, it's Mars is far away.
You can actually check the YouTube stream of Starman as he
that
slowly
man
gets
with
away.
The helmet in the car with the steering wheel.
Yeah, Starman.
It freaks me out.
Did you see what they put on the LCD display?
Don't panic.
Yeah, isn't it good?
Well, I feel a bit violated because I'm a big fan
Nick,
of Hitchhiker's Guide to
Nick
the Galaxy.
Nick hates anybody doing anything new. Everything old is brilliant, and anything new is a waste of time. Isn't that right, Nick?
It takes me a while to get convinced.
He wants to be back in with his stained glass window and his 11 a.m. wine
and
his
daiquiri
in my kind of smoking jacket slippers.
My bit of news that I really loved was this killer whale that has learned how to mimic human speech. And I've actually got a little sound clip.
I've heard this.
Have you?
It's great. Yeah, it's great.
So this whale is called Wiki, and she has very quickly learned how to repeat some of the noises that her trainer makes to her. So just have a little listen.
Hello.
Yeah, I can hear it. I don't know. It maybe not that convincing. But.
Yeah, so this me and my brother had a big kind of talk about this. It was sort of saying she a little of them, like the trainer will say like 1, 2 and she'll be like and like some of them don't sound that familiar, but when you look at the frequency, the wavelength frequencies, she is actually making really similar frequencies to the human voice. And it was kind of just like, oh, this is just some really joyful science. Like, I don't know how useful it's going to be to anybody. I mean, technically, the study was done because they're saying that orcas are known to communicate amongst themselves using lots of sounds, and different groups often have different dialects. So they often have their own unique sounds. And maybe these evolve because they use imitation a lot.
Like ear cats, isn't it, on the adverts? Like, and they speak, actually, but in an East European accent.
Yeah, where did it's weird that meerkats
strangely
learn
they don't
English.
Use that when they're weird. You see a bird in the sky. Do you know what I mean? They just make a sound rather than say, yeah,
it's strange.
There is bird in the sky.
They also like live in houses and go to the cinema and stuff, which is where do they get the money? That's what I want to know.
Sergei, what is song number 5?
Very good. So the next song, I wanted to tell you a story, guys. So I want to tell you a story about. So I'm a chemist, right? And one of my favorite, so chemists, when you think of chemistry at school, you think of, I think, acids and bases and things like that. And my favorite acid, my absolute favorite, is a acid called aqua regia, which means royal water, obviously. But if you've ever seen aqua regia, it's a mixture of two different acids. It's a 3-to-1 mixture of nitric acid and hydrochloric acid. And when you do that, you get this beautiful gold color. It's a lovely thing. And one of the cool things about aqua regia is it dissolves gold, which is very unusual. And gold exists metallically in its metallic form in the world, which is very unusual for most elements. It exists as their oxide, because oxygen is very reactive. And there's been so it's one of the few ways of dissolving gold, like, you know, your tea, your sugar would dissolve in your tea. And there's a beautiful story set by a Hungarian chemist called George Dehevesy. George Dehevesy was working in Nazi-occupied Denmark. He was working at the Niels Bohr Institute. And there were two other chemists there who'd won Nobel Prizes. A guy called Max von Laue, who won the Nobel Prize for showing that X-rays can be diffracted by crystals. And John Frank, who won a Nobel Prize for about the study of ionization. Anyway, so when you win a Nobel Prize, you get this like beautifully big slab of gold. It's huge. It's about the size of about twice the size of a wagon wheel.
If I got it, I'd try to unwrap it and eat it. Yeah,
he would. You know, like when you go to at Christmas, when you go to Marks and Sparks and you see that huge like one big coin. It's about that big, made of solid gold. And they'd won it, and they were working. They were actually working on trying to make synthetic rubber. They were trying. They were kind of doing organic chemistry. And because of for the war effort, and the Nazis started confiscating all of the gold, as you'd imagine, in the Reich. In the Third Reich, it's very important to be able to not move gold around, and you could confiscate that for the war effort. But because it's not just a bit of gold, this is a Nobel Prize. It's so valuable to scientists. George De Hesse comes in and goes, guys, got an idea. So he takes their gold, and he makes up some aqua regia because he was an organic chemist. George De Hesse discovered hafnium. So anyway, he dissolves these two gold plaques, these medals of the Nobel Prize, and just so you can't see them. So it just looks like a solution then, right? It doesn't look like there's gold in it. Just pops it on the shelf. Like, so then the Nazis come round and they're like, oh my God, like, we'll come to confiscate your gold. He's like, no gold here, just a load of chemicals on the shelf. You can look at this. So for the whole war, for like 3 years of the war, it stood on the shelf in this lab. And the beautiful bit about the story is after the end of the war, they precipitated the gold that was left in solution. And then they sent that back to the Nobel Committee in Sweden, and they recast the Nobel Prize out of the gold that had been in solution for 3 years.
Clever boy.
Isn't that a beautiful,
That's amazing.
Story? Yeah, so in honor of that wonderful, wonderful chemist, we're going to play Gold with Toss Van Nobel Ballet. Nothing left to make me feel small. Like a slippy standing so
introductions to the Science Shed always involve Nick doing a stupid voice, Brian being one of his favourites.
Oh, mate.
We've actually already met Brian.
Met Brian several times. I do. Those introductions are awesome, though. How many voices do you think how many guests have you had doing this?
There are people who come and people who go, and I couldn't put a number on it. It's probably about 10.
It is impressive. Normally what we do at the end, well, we record the intros to the Science Shed after we've done all of the science. So it's actually quite, when we meet up, we've normally got stuff. You know the normal small talk you normally do when you see a friend you haven't seen for a while? We have to hold that back because we want that kind of preamble before we get involved in some science. We have to like ignore each other when we first see
really?
Each other.
Really? So you're like, hi, how was your day? I mean...
Yeah,
science. Tell me your name.
Exactly. And then we always do the intros at the end when we record it. And it's always impressive to me sometimes how Nick can just pull out someone from Eastern Europe or someone from, you know, France or someone from Ireland or whatever. It's impressive. Well, it's a wasted skill in academic science, unfortunately. It's not much cool for kind of, you know, slightly better than average accents.
It's not always... PC either.
Yeah, sometimes there's been quite a few that have not been made. Final cut, but I can say one in particular.
The Irish one's all right. You can do the bloody Irish one. It all means Paddy. That one.
Yeah, Paddy.
Is that all right? Is that not?
We had two Irish people that introduced the Science Shed once. I think. Yeah, we did them. Done them twice, but they were different people.
Like from different parts of Ireland.
Once we had to. We did exactly. We did. We had one that we were... We had one where we had to... we were apart because we couldn't get together because the trains were broken. So we had to like think up an excuse to communicate with each other. So we did it over the phone. And we did it that Nick happened to walk into a phone rang in an Australian shed. And some random Australian picked it up so we could speak. So we have sometimes you have to be a bit creative.
We use it as a tool to sort of say what the Science Shed's about, really. So each time we introduce it, it's more like, you know, there's an ignorant person with a funny accent who asks Steve, what's this shed? What's going on in this shed? Who are you? Why are you here? That's basically what
So it's that person stumbling in, and then you have to say, like, what's going on
Steve
and what you're
explains
about.
It. Yeah, yeah. I do. And then so the listener can understand... Mm-hmm.
So basically, Brian is the embodiment of the listener.
I think, well, he's the number one fan, I think.
Oh, mate.
What's been like your podcast journey? Because you said it right at the beginning that the very first one was this crackly microphone and you didn't know what you were doing, and it's pretty professional now. So.
I think it's Do you know what, though? It's made me, as a in my professional job, in my grown-up job, it's made me a much better communicator, very much so. Because I tell you why, because I stand up, you know, and have stood up and given research talks a lot in my career, but you never listen to yourself, right? Mm. And so you, the act of being sat down and having to edit the podcast means that you listen back to what you said and how you tried to communicate something. And you know, obviously, what you intended to communicate. And you get to see sometimes that difference between what, you know, oh, that was really badly explained, and actually I did a pretty good job there. So in areas that, you know, that are completely distinct to us talking about, you know, something stupid about dissolving gold or whatever, it's actually been really useful. So I think, you know, I'd recommend anybody that's considering doing it. If we can do it, anyone can do it. It's really not that hard, you know, and it's much easier now with things like, with you know, various technologies. It's not a lot of money. So I think it's been massively positive. I don't know. What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I like it.
See?
Have you gone back and listened to the first shows? What do you think about them?
Oh, it's so cringy.
I have to say that when we do them now, it's because we do them every fortnight, and it tends to be quite a lot of work to edit them all together. So by the time we've done that and you're working on the next one, you haven't really got time to sort of properly listen. So you listen to bits. You check you haven't libeled anyone or anything like that. But yeah. Generally, when we first did them, I would listen back and I would sort of start to slowly hate myself. Now I don't listen back, so I can't hate myself anymore.
Do you know what I have done, though? I mean, you guys must get this too, because you have your own podcast, is that when you first start doing it, you have that horrible thing where you hear your own voice. And you're like, oh, do I really sound like that?
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Oh, my weird vocal tics.
Exactly.
And the funny words I slip in.
But then after a while, you get used to it. And at some point, I was doing something the other day, and like I laughed at my own joke that I said 2 weeks ago. That was a good one. I would have totally said that, because you switch off. It's ridiculous. But yeah, it's fun nonetheless.
The other thing I noticed, that exactly the same as you guys, like when we first started this, I would religiously listen back to every recording. Like after we'd edited it, I would then listen to it as a whole thing, like on my phone. And like the really early science mixtapes, someone will say what their song is, and I feel like I have to comment on their choice of song. I'm just like, excellent choice, or whatever. And it's like, the listener doesn't care what I think about the song. And you had to sort of train yourself to be like, no, cut out all your silly comments that aren't relevant.
I'm intrigued, Matilda. What was the song you thought was bad? Was it Gold by Spandau Ballet? It probably was.
No,
it.
You saw me dancing along. So we're actually going to be on your podcast as well.
That's right.
Where can listeners find that if they want to hear us being in the Science Shed?
So we are available on iTunes and on SoundCloud. You can find us on Twitter. We are at the Science Shed on Twitter, and then also our individual Twitter handles. I'm at Steve the Chemist,
and I'm at the Evans Lab. You can also find us on SoundCloud if you just search for the Science Shed, all one word. You'll find us on SoundCloud.
Great. And we'll try and put a link to it in the bio for this one as well. Now, finally, the brain teaser. Anybody got any clues? Any clues? Any ideas? You know what it is.
I don't know. Right. So you were saying, wait, hang on. So
let's repeat the brain teaser.
What did the scientist say when he found two isotopes of helium? Now, you're saying there are two isotopes of helium?
There are more than two, but there's
three and four?
Three and four are the most predominant, yeah. Helium-3, I believe, is a superfluid. So actually, if you fill up a bucket of helium-3, it has to be very cold. It's about 4 Kelvin, so minus 270-odd degrees centigrade. It actually creeps out the middle. If you imagine like a jet of water just being pushed out, it just does that by itself if you just have a bucket of helium.
No, that's magic, Steve. That can't happen.
It's crazy how stuff behaves weirdly when it's cold.
Yeah, it does.
I certainly behave weirdly when I'm cold.
I just make weird noises.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay, so, best guess?
Four.
Okay, you think that? Yeah, cool. Can tell you that's wrong.
Hee-hee.
Yeah, you guys are both right, yeah.
Yeah.
Hee-hee.
The isotope 3. Don't need the isotope. It was the red herring.
Because it's two heliums. It's H-E and H-E.
Yeah, I was overthinking it.
Just got to go from the gut sometimes.
Kick.
So well done to any listeners who got that as well. And your final song.
So before this comes on, I've got a special gift for Steve.
All right.
This bag here.
Yeah, really?
I brought Steve a present.
I hate when he does this.
So I'm a massive Rush fan. I like progressive rock. and I especially like Rush.
No, so not just a big Rush fan. Like Nick, we can do this after the podcast has ended if you want to play Challenge Nick. You can play any bit of any Rush song ever for a second, and he'll tell you what the song is.
Just talking about Rush, I'm getting a tingling in my loins.
That's kind of impressive. I think I'm going to try that.
I mean, I don't like Rush. I don't like it. But I love Nick's enthusiasm for it. And a few times I've been over his house and we've had a few glasses of wine. The end evening nearly always ends up with a glass of whiskey and a Rush album.
By touring the Snow Dog.
And Nick just telling me about a drum solo that's going to come up or some timing signature, which is amazing. All right, I've got
a present. But anyway, when we were in not long after we met in America, Steve and I, we went for a meal. And we were a couple of science geeks in Stanford. And I was wearing a Rush Tour t-shirt, which was way too tight. And it's quite a geeky thing to do, is wear a Rush Tour t-shirt from 1977. Steve was wearing a t-shirt that said 98% chimp on it. And we were enjoying a meal, minding our own business. Before you knew it, a chap came over and started heckling Steve about evolution and how, you know, about God and God being the...
I was just trying to enjoy my nice Japanese
And we
meal.
Were just having a little meal wearing our crap t-shirts. Steve tried to defend the chimp t-shirt. But you know what? I've never seen him wear it since.
I was shamed. I was t-shirt shamed.
So in honour of that, Steve, open your gift.
Nick, thanks so much. All right, I'm going to have to open this quickly.
Here you go. This is...
Oh, it's a t-shirt that says, "Back off, man, I'm a scientist," from Peter Venkman and Ghostbusters.
So when next time you go out for a Korean meal with somebody, you don't have to offend a religious person.
That's really kind of you. Thank you so much. So the last song we've chosen is partially a Rush. It's a Rush song because Nick loves Rush so much. And it's also
going to get all serious.
There's a lyric in it, which I think is just, it embodies what it is to be, I think, to be an experimental scientist. There's a lyric in this song where he says, his mind is not for rent by any god or government, always hopeful yet discontent. And that to me just embodies exactly what it means, always hopeful. Like, oh, this experiment's always going to work, but it just never does. It's always so frustrating. And that's the kind of joy and the frustration, I suppose, from doing experimental science.
Tom Sawyer.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, guys.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
It has been a ball.